believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Great Britain and has worked in art museums throughout the world. Since 1999, he's been the director, president, and CEO of the Detroit Institute of Arts. The DIA is one of the top six museums in America and recently completed a six-year, $158 million renovation and reinstallation. Also, he's recently been named one of 11 Michiganians of 2007. His name, Graham Beal. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible, presented by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR. Brought to you by Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm. Now, here's Jack.
We're with the director, president, and CEO of the Detroit Institute of Arts, Graham Beal. Graham, welcome. It's an honor to have you.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Do you get a salary for each one of those three titles?
I guess you could put it that way, yes.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your parents?
My mother and father met towards the end of World War II. They were from different parts of the country. My father was from the south of England, a true Saxon. My mother was of Welsh and Irish background. They were of different social classes, which is quite significant in Britain. My father was a journeyman electrician, and my mother came from a rather more comfortable background. But during the war, my father was wounded. He was on active service in the Pacific on an aircraft carrier. Was wounded, and it's thought that this wound was where he developed a kidney disease that was ultimately to kill him. He spent most of my childhood, he spent in a form of invalid state, and he took up painting as a way of passing the time. My mother, as it happened, before she married my father, had hoped to become a dress designer and go to art school. That never happened because of the war. My father died when I was 15. My mother did whatever she could to pay the bills. We lived with her father I grew up in a seaside town called Bexhill-on-Sea, which was a sort of Edwardian seaside resort, and it had turned into the area of the country where everyone retired to the sort of the Florida of England. We called it the Costa Geriatrica.
Graham Beal, where did you get your love for art?
Well, I think it was because of my parents and my father painting and drawing. Both my sister and I, one way to be with him was to be there painting and drawing too. And he also, courtesy of the National Health Service, used to go up to London to see a specialist on a regular basis. And every so often he would take either my sister or me out of school for the day, and we would go up to London with him and visit art museums. I, as a little insensitive boy, really wanted to go to places like the Imperial War Museum and the United Forces Museum and this kind of thing, but he insisted on going to the Tate Gallery and the National Gallery.
What is art?
Well, there are many definitions of art. Some people grew up with the notion, as I did, that art is more or less what artists say it is. You can define art in many different ways. I like what the British philosopher and novelist Iris Murdoch said, that art is about telling the truth. And for some truths, it's the only tool available. And I think that's what artists are trying to do. And as she went on to say, that beauty is present when truth finds apt form. In other words, when you find the right way to say something, then you deliver something that has meaning and has the power to change the way people see the world.
Throughout the course of history, Graham Beal, what do the best artists all have in common?
I can only answer that really from the point of view of someone who spent a lot of time as a curator with living artists. I was a curator of contemporary art at two museums. And the thing that struck me most was that whether or not they were successful and well-known, famous, they really could do nothing else but make art. It was like they were compelled to make it. They had something they wanted to say. Nothing they ever made really in their own minds got there, you know, it was always inferior. The artist Frank Auerbach, who's now an old man, said that every day as he grew older, he found it more and more difficult to do anything other than go to the studio to make art.
Graham Beale, what's the greatest piece of art your eyes have ever seen?
I suppose if I had to pick one work of art, which is very difficult. I can think of dozens ranging from a landscape garden in Scotland to paintings in the Louvre and elsewhere. But I would probably pick Diego Velázquez's painting called Las Meninas in the Prado in Madrid.
Art oftentimes changes lives and souls. How is that?
Well, I think it goes back to what I was saying just a few minutes ago, is that a true work of art opens a window on the world, makes you see things very, very differently, reveals an aspect of life and truth. And that, I mean, to me, that ultimately defines whether something is a work of art or simply a piece of craftsmanship.
I've been to the Louvre a number of times, you know, and the most famous thing arguably there is the Mona Lisa, tiny painting.
Right.
The eyes do move. Her eyes move. How do you explain how famous that little painting is?
Well, it was always famous because it's so enigmatic. That smile is really quite remarkable. I can't think of another portrait before the advent of, well, Frans Hals, of course, painted smiling people, but it's very, very rare. I think the real reason is that about a little over 100 years ago, a very... a very eloquent British scholar at Oxford, Walter Pater, wrote a magnificent essay about this work of art, and it caught the imagination of Victorians, of all English-speaking people in the late 19th century, were educated through this essay and saw the work of art through the eyes of this particular man, and it became famous. And that's once, as Andy Warhol demonstrated, once you're famous, that's all you need to go on attracting attention.
We're talking to Graham Beale. When we come back, we'll ask him about the 6-year renovation and reinstallation of the DIA. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible, presented by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Brought to you by Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
Welcome back. We're with Graham Beale, who's been called the Bowtied Rebel. Graham, for 6 years, you and your team led a $158 million renovation and reinstallation of the DIA. And we're the beneficiaries of that. Talk about that renovation.
Well, it really started because the wings that were added in the north and south to the original building, added in the late 60s, early 70s, were falling apart. The granite was falling off. There was no vapor barrier. There was no insulation, single pane glazing. So the metal inside the building that held it up was beginning to rust out. So that had to be taken care of. And as they were taking care of that, they decided to do some internal renovations and make the building easier to get around for the people. It was a very confusing building after the additions were put on. So fairly soon, just about every part of the building was being renovated, and that is, in fact, what happened. When I came here in 1999, I saw that going. I didn't particularly want to do another building project. They're headaches, and this was my fifth as both chief curator and as a director. But I also realized that that when the work was done on the building, the works of art would have to be put back in the galleries. We would have to do a reinstallation. And I think the general mindset at the time was that, well, everything would more or less go back where it was before. And, you know, why not? That's the way it had been for 100 years. And so I remember coming here and mentioning that we were probably going to need another 10 million or so on top of what we already were raising to reinstall the permanent collection. Because at that time, I had a sense that we needed to do things a little differently than we had been doing in the past.
Speaking of going to the board and saying, we need an extra $10 million, what was it like the day you had to go to the board and say, we have this asbestos issue and, board, we need an extra $40 million?
Yeah, that was the worst day of my professional career. We all get knocked, run down from time to time, metaphorically, but it really took me a while to get over that one. We broke the news gradually over a couple of executive committee and board meetings as we worked out exactly what the implications were. It was $40 million was what it cost to absolutely cure the building completely, not leave any problems for anyone else. We could have spent $20 million and sealed off certain areas, made the records of where it was, but that would have left the work to be dealt with by our successors whenever they wanted to do any work in the wing that would have been left, the north wing. And we decided that now was the time to deal with the whole thing for all sorts of reasons, building, health, legal, all of those things.
You staked your professional reputation, Granville. You thought outside the box. You broke the model. And you took great heat from the critics. Why? How did you think outside the box, and why did you think outside the box?
I grew up with art. Art was a natural part of my life, and it had brought great wealth, both emotionally, intellectually, into my life. I thought that art was good for you. If people who liked art, who made art, it seemed to me there was a tremendous amount of joy and pleasure and understanding there, and. So I sort of had that missionary quality to me in going into museums. But I was a curator of contemporary art as a failed painter. When I'd got my graduate qualifications, I worked for 17, 18 years as a curator of contemporary art. And didn't realize until I went working in specialist museums, contemporary museums, didn't realize until I went to work in a general art museum as director, I began to understand the great gap that separated the general visitor from the kind of experience with art that I thought was quite natural. And it was when I was a director at Joslin Art Museum in Omaha that I began to perceive that within our own docents, teaching the docents, I could see that these were people, they were baffled, and that what I was teaching them and others were teaching them didn't seem, it gave them a kind of understanding, but it didn't seem to connect them in the art with the way that I thought was most meaningful. And so there I began to experiment. And over the next 10 years, or the next 5 or 6 years probably, carried out a few experiments, all of which now I can look back on as sort of noble failures.
Granville, all of us are beneficiaries in the fact that you're a failed artist. God had bigger plans for you than just being a painter. So talk to us about taking risks. You took a huge risk. A lot of us are looking at new careers, uncertainty, et cetera, and it's very tough for us to take risks. Please.
Well, I think I knew that there was going to be resistance from certain quarters, but I had become utterly convinced. And when I came to Detroit, I was very fortunate in inheriting a small core of individuals who had already been trying to work in this direction, curators, educators, who had been doing so. I could see when I came here to be interviewed, I could see that people were trying some things out here that I thought was very, very interesting. And I don't want to downplay the sense of risk. In fact, a couple of trustees told me to stop being so apologetic when I talked about what I thought we were going to be doing. So I was very aware of it, but I was just so convinced that we were onto something. And as I talked to fellow directors around the world, and I mean around the world, being on a panel at the Vatican in 2005 as part of a symposium to talk about the direction of museums, for example, I realized that many, many directors were rethinking the relationship of their institution, their museums, to their general public, doing it in different ways. Henri Loiret, the director of the Louvre, for example, is trying to find a way to make his museum free to French people, because it's a tourist museum, basically. And the French government takes all the revenues from the Louvre. He doesn't get them. And then they dish it out, you know. So Henri is running up against the fact that the French government doesn't want to stop charging. That's his challenge. Mine, there are other challenges elsewhere. But the challenge that many directors I know, which is why we're being watched so closely, we understand in a way perhaps that the specialist critics don't, that we have to change our relationship with the general public. We can no longer go on being a specialist institution designed for specialists by specialists, and basically catering to them first and foremost, and hoping, as we have done for the past 100 years, that the general public can somehow catch up.
Speaking of taking risks, one of the things you need when you take risk is true self-confidence. How does one get true self-confidence?
I'm not sure, frankly, how self-confident I am. But it was the conviction that was shared by I knew was shared by others in the business, other people who I respected, who I cared about, fellow directors who'd been trying different things. It's just having the conviction that this is something that is absolutely right and is going to pay off. And I suppose actually having tried many of the components that I was advocating for the permanent collection were things that we've been doing in special exhibitions for 20 or 30 years, which no one had bothered about because special exhibitions come and go. So if a critic didn't like a corner of a gallery that was too noisy, they would say to themselves, it's noisy, but it's going away in 12 weeks. That won't be anymore. But asserting that you're going to put these things into a permanent collection, which is where the specialists like to spend their time, was really intruding on their space. But I knew it worked. We knew it worked, and we had that confidence from experience.
You had some employees that gravitated toward this transformation. Then you had others that didn't believe in it, whether they told you that to your face or not. How did you win over those employees?
Well, I won some of them over by demonstrating that it wasn't the end of the world, it wasn't barbarians inside of the gate. The curators, for example, still had absolute control of the intellectual content of what was going in there. What the curators did not have that they were used to having was the final say in how things were going to look in the galleries. And in a couple of cases, quite frankly, I basically just took a couple of individuals out of the process because they weren't being helpful. So I did use just, you know, raw executive. That's what I'm the CEO for.
The buck stops here. We're talking to Graham Beall. When we come back, we'll ask him about this world-class treasure we all have, the DIA. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Presented by Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm. Now, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
We're talking to Graham Beall, who was just named one of 11 Michiganians of 2007. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Quite an honor. One of many. Talk to us about this world-class treasure, Graham, we have in the DIA.
Well, the DIA is simply one of the greatest art museums in this country and in the Western Hemisphere, in the world. It's an extraordinary collection. It's relatively small, 60,000 pieces, as opposed to other museums that have 500,000 or 1 million or more. But the quality of what we have is absolutely exceptional. And it was really founded in the 1920s by a combination of the director, William Valentina, a German, who came here in 1920, supported by the Booth family and then the Ford family and also Robert Hudson Tannehill, all young men, Edsel Ford, in the 20s. And with a combination of the wealth that was coming out of the city of Detroit and the wealth of these individuals, William Valentina was able to transform between 1920 and 1930. He transformed the DIA from a perfectly respectable Midwestern institution into one of the great collections of this country. And it will all, nothing will change that. It will always remain one of the greatest collections. You simply cannot buy the DIA collection now if you wanted to. If you had all the money in the world, you could not put together a collection such as the DIA's.
10 to 12,000 guests a day, a week rather. 300 employees, 800 volunteers, 90 galleries going to 130.
Mm-hmm.
And each year you spend $3 million on acquisitions. We've got all this extra stuff already in the basement. Why do we need more?
History, contrary to many people's understanding, doesn't stand still. We see things differently as time passes. As those opinions and values change, so you realize that there is something that you could have for the collection that will speak to other works of art in a way that they might not have done before. There are just valuable things out there that you want. $3 million doesn't get you an awful lot these days, but we do buy every year. We buy very significant pieces because they're on the market, they're available, and as I say, they amplify our understanding of the works of art that we already have.
Who do you buy this stuff from?
Mainly art museums work with dealers, and dealers know which museums, of course, have funds. But we also bid at auction, which is a little tricky for an institution with all of its governance procedures, but we do that. And we also go to art fairs, the main one being the Maastricht Art Fair that happens in southern Netherlands every March. Those are the three main areas. Of course, we occasionally, as we did very recently, acquired a spectacular tea service directly from a private collection.
In today's world, Graham Beale, you have to keep learning while you're earning. And you're a real student. And one entity that you've really studied has been Disney. What have you learned from Disney?
Well, I learned that from Disney, it reinforced in my mind the sense, the importance of telling a story, and the importance of telling a story that has meaning to the general public. The story that we'd told for 100 years was the story of art. We're art historians. We were trained like that. We'd come to think of it as a natural way of learning about art. We'd all forgotten that, in fact, we became art historians because something had grabbed us by some works of art or something, and we wanted to learn more. But our initial response to a work of art was very basic, very human, emotional, rather than intellectual. And those are the kind of messages that you get across with stories, and that's what Disney is great at telling, either on the screen or in the Disney parks. The thing that I learned most specifically from Disney was to... and this is where one of the ways we were accused of dumbing down by the critics, especially when you mention the word Disney, it sounds like you don't have respect for your audience, where the opposite is true, is not giving individuals too many choices. Disney gives you two choices. It's a binary choice, yes or no, this way or that way. Never gives you more than two choices you go through the park. And that's what we've tried to do at the DIA. We've tried to simplify getting through the museum so the general public is not consumed with wondering how they're going to get out of here if they get lost, making it that part, that anxiety, which many people bring to museums, especially if they come from guests from out of town, which is a very common time to visit a museum. We wanted to make the experience as plain sailing as possible. And I very much learned from Disney.
How do you choose the exhibits, and what exhibits are coming soon?
We are, being what we call a universal or encyclopedic museum, we cover many, many areas. So the various curatorial departments are always, in a sense, competing for spaces. We used to choose exhibitions. When I was a curator, I simply had to get the director to agree that an exhibition was a good idea. And then everything else fell into place. The registrars did what they were supposed to do, the education department, or waited on the word of the curator. That's changed in many, many places. Now when we have an exhibition idea, the curators review it to make sure that it has integrity. And then it goes in front of once it's been, the idea has been approved by me, it goes in front of a committee drawn from that has on it individuals from development, from finance, from education, from marketing and public relations, where the whole package is analyzed. Basically, when an exhibition costs $1 million or more, sometimes as much as $3 million, we're really saying, if we're going to spend the DI's money on this, what is the person going to take away? What's its value? And that's no longer just a curatorial decision. It's a decision that the whole institution has to make.
We're talking to Graham Beale, the director of the DIA. Graham, we would be remiss if we didn't talk about the chairman of the board of the DIA, Gene Gagarl, and his wife, Marianne.
Mm-hmm.
Please.
Well, Gene is the chairman of the board. I sometimes wonder how he gets his day job done. He's an extremely committed individual. The other side of the coin, as far as the DIA is concerned, is that whereas we are well known for our collection and being able to add to our collection, we're also the poster child in the American Art Museum world of having financial problems on a yearly basis, because we always struggle to meet our operating budget. We're a 30-something million dollar a year operation. We have a very small general operating endowment, and so Gene and I and my colleagues in the development department and other trustees simply have to raise a huge amount of money every year. And Gene has made an extraordinary commitment of his time and effort to helping keep the DIA doors open for our general public.
Speaking of giving, this world-class treasure, the DIA, has been built by Michiganders with a giving soul through the decades. There's never been a Brinks truck in a funeral procession that I've seen. Talk to us about giving.
Well, the DIA is extremely dependent upon people continuing to give. To that end, we have a development department that's actually larger in the number of staff than all of our curatorial departments put together, because of the amount of money that we have to raise. And we urge people to become members. You can become members at a family level for about $80, or all the way up to $10,000 or $20,000, which gives you wonderful privileges to meet with the director and the chairman and those kinds of things. We hope that people will remember us in the last gift that they ever make to the world through their estates. And we have quite an elaborate staff structure that can help people direct their money towards the DI should they so wish.
You should be in charge of development, Graham Beale. We're talking to Graham Beale, and I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm, presents Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with the director, president, and CEO of the Detroit Institute of Arts, Graham Beale. Graham, why should a family come to the DIA?
Well, basically because there's quite a bit to do. If you come at the weekends or on Friday evenings, there are all kinds of events. There's the art, which is at the core of the experience, and I believe that we've made it infinitely more accessible and exciting than it has been in the past in any museum anywhere. But we also have drop-in workshops, storytellers for children in the galleries. There are lectures, those kinds of things are happening as well.
When young people come to the DIA, what surprises you, Graham Beale, the most?
I can't give anything specific, but I do like to eavesdrop on what they say, the young children, how they respond to something when they're not being guided, to see what grabs them and what doesn't, and how they respond to something. And sometimes they're almost more prim than you would expect. They can be sort of disgusted by something in a way that that is quite interesting. But very often they just have, you know, they're responding. It's they're making their immediate response, and it's a very honest and unshielded response.
In the DIA, you have 50 quote unquote play eye spy stations. Tell us about that.
Well, one of the things that we've done with the DIA throughout in the new installation is to try to make everything as interactive as possible. And this goes all the way down to just a simple descriptive label. We, rather than give some information to explain what a work is about, we give information to the visitor to have them look at the work of art and figure it out for themselves. So even that is interactive, but the iSpy stations are part of a number of interactive, we call them low-tech interactives, whereby it's mounted a little, these stations are mounted a little bit, it's a plaque mounted a little bit lower on the wall for children, it says Play iSpy in rather large lettering, and then there's a little lid, and on that lid is a little ditty that gives you clue number one. It says clue number one, and then it says lift this for the second clue, and when you lift that, there's a detail of a work of art in that gallery, and you can go and look for it. And that's another way that we get people to actually look at the works of art, looking for something. And it's successful with, as I say all the time, and I'm not being facetious, children of all ages.
You know, you say you've been in America for 35 years, but you still are a Brit, a little ditty.
Well, it's not a poem, so.
The dining table.
Mm-hmm.
Absolute heresy. Tell us.
Well, one of the things about works of art that we have in the collection, because they come from centuries long ago, very often, is they look very strange. And you can't figure out what on earth they were used for. What human purpose did these things have? Because every work of art exists because someone somewhere wanted something made for a particular purpose, usually by someone else. And with the 18th century European material, you have all of these extraordinary, complicated, expensive-looking objects that look quite foreign. So to describe how some of them are used, we recreated an 18th century banquet, which is essentially a projection down onto a table in the middle of the gallery, and you actually see being used through this projection. You sit down, it's as if you're being served dinner. You see some of the objects around you being used. And when we described this, of course, it sounded to our critics like it was going to be this glaring, unpleasant thing in the middle of a gallery, but it's been a phenomenal success. And I've seen specialists absolutely entranced and very pleased with this particular thing. So it's really the icon of our reinstallation.
From personal experience, I second that nomination. How can we learn more about the DIA?
Well, you can go to our website, dia.org, or you can call our general number, which is 313-833-7900, to get more information. But the website's the best place.
How does one work his or her way up to become the director of a major art institute?
The usual path is through degrees in art history, a number of years as a curator, maybe becoming chief curator as part of the step, a senior curator overseeing a whole other curators. Sometimes, as I did as chief curator, I also had responsibility for overseeing conservation and the education departments. And then, you know, sooner or later, you may make the decision to become a director, which in many ways is a step away from the art. You may be in control of an institution, but you have much less to do with art on a daily basis than you would do normally as a curator.
Has your mom ever seen the DIA?
Well, no. My mother unfortunately passed away quite soon after I moved here, and so she never actually saw the DIA itself in person.
You're a leader. You are a leader. What makes a great leader?
Well, I think believing in what you do, you have to be able to deal with people. As they say, common sense isn't very common. I mean, it really is a matter of being clear, having priorities, making clear what those priorities are so that individuals who are working for you understand what they're doing and why.
Another thing you do is Even though times are tough, everything you do, Graham Beal, is classy. First class. Everything Gene Gagaro does is first class. There's listeners out there that say, well, you know, when I get successful, I'll do things classy. But until I get successful, I can't afford to. They never get successful. Talk to us about doing things classy.
Well, to me, it's living with yourself. I mean, art is, you can be very high-minded about it, but art is an extraordinary phenomenon. It's you know, extraordinary things made to tell the truth. And you cannot compromise a museum. When that happens, people get very upset if a museum isn't upholding the highest standards, and you really have to bear that in mind on every occasion. And a lot of the time, that's not a terribly difficult thing. Sometimes, as when I was forced to close down an exhibition, it was an extraordinary difficult decision to make, but I made it in the end, and what I believed was best for the institution and the high position that museums occupy in the minds of our public.
You've also walked to the tune of a different drummer. You start wearing bow ties when you were 14 years old. No kid on the south side of Chicago was wearing them at 14. Talk about walking to the tune of a different drummer.
I suppose in the case of the bow tie, I was always a bit of a fashion horse, and this was London of the 1960s when everybody was very conscious about how you looked. And, you know, bow ties was just something a little different. And for some reason, I've always been interested in the difference rather than the same.
Last question. What advice would you give to our young listeners tonight, Graham Beal?
I think simply, if you can, do what you believe in. Follow the path of the things that you have conviction for. That way you will never really have a kind of 9-to-5 feeling that so many people have.
Graham Beal, you're a visionary, a risk taker, a consensus builder, a leader, and we're the beneficiaries of that.
Thank you.
Thanks for all you do. Speaking of dreamers, our guest next Sunday, another dreamer, Anything Is Possible, Irma Elder. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spock.
Believe in yourself. Yeah. What else can you leave you to look like?